Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Alan Rosenthal. He's an attorney and the co-director of Justice Strategies at the Center for Community Alternatives, a nonprofit organization dedicated to advocating for alternatives to incarceration, raising issues of discrimination in the criminal justice system, and working with people who would otherwise be incarcerated. The organization has offices in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Rochester, and Syracuse. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Grant. Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Let me start with some basic background context to set the stage for some of the things we'll be talking about later. Briefly, if you can, tell me the story of the last 30 years or so of America's path regarding incarceration and how it differs from the path taken by other Western democracies.
When one looks back 30 years, what we see is a country that looked very indistinguishable from other Western countries, incarcerating at about a rate of 100 per 100,000. And that's pretty standard, and that's where most countries have remained over the 30-year period. The distinguishing features of the United States has been a much greater emphasis on punishment as a criminal justice modality. The war on drugs, the war on crime, has taken us in a much different direction. And so what we see over that 30-year period is a sevenfold increase in the rate of incarceration, the number of prisoners, so that we move over 700 per 100,000, while most other countries have remained at 100 per 100,000, moving us to the point where although we are a small percentage of the world's population, down around 5%, we incarcerate about 25% of all of the world's prisoners.
There are folks that point to that trend that you've just outlined and say, well, there's an association, a causal link between that and the fact that our violent crime rates have gone down. So this is sort of evidence of the success of this. What's the overarching argument that you would make for a less incarceration-intensive approach to criminal justice?
Part of what we see when people return to the community is the harm done by the very fact of the incarceration and the very length of the incarceration and the very in some ways, the inhumanity of the incarceration. So the contrast that one might look at is you take a country like Sweden. You talk to their commissioner of prisons, and their philosophy is do no harm. It's not how we look at our prisons. It is. In some ways, the imprisonment and the harsh terms are considered to be part of the punishment. The problem is that 95% of all people who go to prison come home. If the goal is public safety, then at least a balancing concern has to be under what conditions are they coming home? Are they better off than they went? Are they worse off than they went? Are they more likely to commit an offense, or are they less likely? And part of that is internal, what we do in the prisons, but part of that is external, what we do in our communities to support people, both when they come home, or provide programs that create alternatives to going to prison, in light of the fact that we know that harm is done by the very fact of the incarceration.
One of the things you mentioned, Sweden, is a counterexample. And, of course, one of the things that overarches, I think, this entire conversation about incarceration and criminal justice is the role that race plays in this, both for the politics of this, but in so many other different ways when we think about it and we talk about it and the assumptions that we make. And so Sweden obviously is a much more homogeneous country racially than the United States. So could you talk a little bit about if that's also part of your concern?
It is. So the United States has reached this point of what social scientists and criminologists now call mass incarceration. It means one, that you've reached an ahistorical point that looks so unlike all of the other points in history in terms of rates of incarceration and in international comparison, that you're incarcerating at this astronomical rate. The other piece of it, the other piece of the definition, goes to the issue of race, and that is that race becomes such a dominant factor in what's going on within the system that it loses its individualized component and starts to look much more systemic. It is clearly undeniable that at every single juncture, from arrest all the way through to incarceration, that there are huge racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Lots of different reasons all along the way. Only a small portion of it is accounted for by different differences in crime rates. So something goes on in the system that has this effect of cumulative disadvantage, starting from arrest, moving on to arraignment, who gets bail, who doesn't get bail, who gets a plea bargain, who gets probation, who gets incarceration, and so on through.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Alan Rosenthal, co-director of Justice Strategies at the Center for Community Alternatives. Governor Cuomo's budget proposal that, as we're speaking, apparently a deal has been reached with the legislature on this, did include the closing of two state prisons. And so I was curious to get your take, first of all, from a broader perspective, what's New York's recent history when it comes to incarceration? Have there been some deliberate changes that you would applaud? Have there been some important changes with the drug sentencing, for example?
Indeed, there have been some very significant and sweeping changes. New York went from one of the worst states in which we earned the undesirable reputation because of the Rockefeller drug laws, which saw us meting out many, many life sentences. It wasn't unusual for somebody on a drug offense to have 25 to life, 15 to life, 3 to life. And that began to change in 2004. There was a reform in 2004 that changed us from an indeterminate sentencing system, meaning that there might be a life component on a sentence or another meaning of indeterminate sentencing is that your release is a function of going to the parole board. In 2004, we moved to a determinate sentencing system, and we began to allow those people serving the most harsh of life sentences to apply for resentencing. In 2005, it was expanded, and then again in 2009. So when one looks going back to 1971, okay, so marking the year of the Attica Prison Rebellion, New York had a state prison population of about 12,000. At its high water mark, in around 2003, we were up over 72,000. Mm. So a huge increase. And from that point, as a result of the reforms, as the result of some additional investment in alternatives to incarceration, in 2009, the other significant reform was a move towards something called judicial diversion, which would divert both first-time and second-time offenders into treatment programs so that incarceration wasn't the necessary default. That was important because it began to realign us slowly with the rest of the world. Because the medical model and the treatment model, the therapeutic model, was something that had been embraced for 30 years in most other countries. We had rejected it. But over the last 10 years, and particularly since 2009, we've seen the growth of an entirely different model in New York. And so it's brought us to a point where there's still a long way to go, but we're under 60,000.
My guest is Alan Rosenthal. He's an attorney with the Center for Community Alternatives, where he co-directs the Justice Strategies Initiative. Well, you mentioned this before. You were talking about access to higher education, and that is one of the specific areas that you and your organization have been working on. What are the challenges here that those with criminal records face when it comes to trying to go to college?
Let me answer that in two ways. One, to kind of loop us back to the concerns about racial disparities. Okay. And then move forward with regard to, you know, how we've thought through this issue. If the data is correct, and we have no reason to disbelieve it, that the racial disparities lead to about a 6- or 7-fold greater conviction rate for people of color. And if upon leaving the criminal justice system and moving on to the rest of your life, in this case, onto your education. If the criminal justice indicator becomes part of what is looked at for admissions purposes, then it will disproportionately, of necessity, fall on applicants of color. The one thing that we know about education is that it works. It works to reduce recidivism. The more education you have, the greater your chances of upward mobility, the greater your chances of employment, the greater your chances of a better job, and so on. What looks like something race neutral, right? A criminal history screening, we all want to be safer, takes on a racial or ethnic flavor. And Michelle Alexander has written about this. We've spoken about it and done some work on it as well. And that is, are we in this era of the new Jim Crow?
And so what do schools do right now as a matter of course?
About 60% of all colleges in America, colleges and universities, do some sort of criminal history screening. So that means that about 30 or 40% do not. So it's a phenomenon that's taken hold over the last decade. It's on the rise. When one looks at whether crime on campus of those schools that screen looks any different than crime on campus of those that don't screen, what you find is there is no difference. And so you start to ask the question, what is it we're screening for?
Well, that's one kind of, I suppose, box that you're looking to ban. There's another one that's been in the news here locally when it comes to employment, this idea of banning the box checking off whether you have a criminal record when you're applying for a job. Can you tell me a little bit about where you folks have stood on that? And I'm also curious to know, my understanding is it just got pulled back from the city council's agenda. So what happened there?
Employment plays a critical role, as we know, in the person's reentry and reintegration back into society after going through the criminal justice system. That's true whether you go to prison, whether you get a fine, are on probation. There is this record that you have and this experience. Some states, and New York was quite frankly in the forefront of establishing laws that prohibited discrimination simply based upon a person's criminal history record or arrest record. In New York, that dates all the way back to 1976 and the Hugh Carey administration. The problem is that enacting those laws still left a substantial loophole. And over probably the last decade, employers have taken advantage of that loophole by putting the criminal history question on the employment application.
So why did it get pulled back? This initiative was on the agenda, and it got pulled back. Why?
Yes. It has passed in 7 states. 44 municipalities around the country have passed this. it got pulled back for some good reasons, and partly because the groundwork, the education, the purpose of it, that work wasn't sufficiently done. And in part, it got pulled back because of some very significant disinformation disseminated by some business interests, absolutely mischaracterizing what the legislation purported to do. And so in their attempt to drive fear, how it was characterized is that it would take away all employers' rights to forever and always look at and evaluate a person's criminal history record. Indeed, that's not true. It simply moved the inquiry to a more meaningful point so that it's not on the application. All applicants are considered on the merits. A person comes in for an interview. You fall in love with that person. They're full of enthusiasm. They look like they can do the job. At that point, you tender an offer. You're my best candidate. But we're going to do a criminal history record. And we're going to evaluate two factors. One is there a direct relationship between your crime and the job that I'm going to put you in, right? So was your offense stealing lollipops from little kids and you're applying for a daycare job? Or is it a crime, or is there a history that makes me concerned for public safety in my workplace? If neither of those two exceptions exist, you get the job. If they exist, an employer then is well within their rights to say, sorry, we're moving on to the next candidate.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with Alan Rosenthal from the Center for Community Alternatives. More personal question for you now. You've worked with thousands of people trying to rebuild their lives, and your organization has worked with them. Is there one person's story that stays with you more than the others?
The story that sticks out in my mind was a woman who had – and she was probably 40 years old. Had very marginal jobs all of her life, been on and off of public assistance. But she was very, very skilled at computers. And a new bank was coming to town. And she applied, and she had just the skills they wanted. And I had never seen this before, but they said, you're our top candidate. We're sending you down to New York City, all expenses paid. To participate in a month-long training program, and then you're going to get started. 2 weeks into the training program, and she's living in a hotel and had thought she had caught the brass ring. They called her in and they said, "Your FBI check has come back. You have an arrest from 20 years ago, an arrest in New Jersey." And unless you can straighten this out in 2 weeks, we're going to have to let you go. And she called me the next day, and I knew that there was no way that this could be done in 2 weeks. And I searched, made all sorts of phone calls. And being from New Jersey, I thought I could call in some favors. And indeed, 2 weeks went by, and we couldn't trace it down. It was so old, not in the court computerized files. No one could find the old files. And she lost the job. Mm. Ends up back on public assistance. A month later, I'm still trying to find out what the hell's going on. I did talk with a secretary who had been at the district attorney's office in Essex County, New Jersey, for a long time. And she said, you know, we don't have those files any longer. It wasn't computerized. But I do remember that we had a card catalog where we hand wrote down what was going on with every case. They're in dead storage, but let me look and see. And she called me back the next day. I found the card. She was arrested, and it was dismissed the next day at the request of the prosecutor. Hmm. Lost job.
Did she ever get it back? That's it?
That was her. No, she had her one shot at the brass ring, and that was it.
Well, looking down the road into the future, do you see us entering any kind of different era in our thinking about incarceration? Are we going to kind of sort of trundle along thinking about the way we've been thinking about it?
No, I am, although not normally optimistic, I am optimistic that there is a light at the end of the mass incarceration tunnel. We will continue to struggle with the aftermath for a long time, but I think our numbers will come down for some very practical reasons. One, prison doesn't work. Two, it is counterproductive. Three, it is very, very expensive. And as we learn more about treatment, as we learn more about alternatives to incarceration, and indeed as even some prosecutors begin to embrace this notion that there are needs for reentry programs. But if you believe in the need for reentry programs that come after prison, then you also have to believe in the value of the alternative to incarceration that occurs immediately after arrest, that there are people who simply don't need to go to prison, that there are other ways to extract some form of punishment. But indeed, the newest of the goals for sentencing, which is to promote reentry and reintegration and a new way of thinking about this, help drive us away from prison as the default.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Round 13.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I fear that I have an intolerance for people who masquerade their selfishness as a virtue.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
In 2006, I was most surprised that a piece of legislation that I had a hand in working on passed unanimously, both in the Assembly and the Senate, a near impossible feat. And it was the most dramatic of changes. It changed the penal law in New York so that we moved from the four very basic goals of sentencing, which were deterrence and incapacitation and rehabilitation, to add a fifth goal, which was to promote the individual's reentry and reintegration back into society.
Well, that was Alan Rosenthal. Alan, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Grant. Pleasure being here.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest.
Support comes from the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University, dedicated to the study and practice of citizenship, leadership, and public governance. Information at campbellinstitute.org.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender, Kelly Coleman, John Fornoff, Stephanie Lee, Hennish Pullickle, and Sophia Celeste Tate, and recording engineer Tom Fazio. For more information on the Campbell Conversations, visit WRVO.org.